Hello! Welcome to Fave This, a podcast about fandom and internet culture, and also video games. I am Gita Jackson, and I am joined by...
Hey, it's Patricia Hernandez.
Hell yeah, it's Patricia Hernandez. So, Patricia, the first thing we're going to talk about today is something that I think is very important to us that happened right after the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. There was a new Cloverfield movie that literally released the second the Super Bowl was over.
Mm-hmm. I actually didn't watch the Super Bowl, but I was tuning in to find out when the movie was going to drop because I really like 10 Cloverfield Lane. I never watched the first one, but I really loved 10 Cloverfield Lane. So I was like, I need to know what this is about. And also because Ava DuVernay was talking about it on Twitter and she was hyping it up. And I was like, I got to watch this. It's going to be good.
Yeah.
It wasn't good. But sorry, go ahead.
I watched the first Cloverfield movie in theaters. I got really into the ARG and everything. Mm-hmm. It is just exactly my shit. Mm-hmm. One of those things where I think 10 Cloverfield Lane is legitimately good. But the first one is a lot of good ideas and then a big mess, sort of like most of J.J. Abrams' work. And then this most recent one was just a huge, awful mess, but I also loved it. 10 Cloverfield Lane was not originally in the Cloverfield oeuvre and then got added later, and you can kind of tell.
But I can't tell if that's the case for the latest movie too. But before we start talking about that, I never watched the first one, but I did kind of consume a lot of the ARG stuff, and I feel like I'm weird because I did the exact same thing with the Blair Witch Project, where I didn't watch the movie, but I consumed everything related to it. I was so reading funny. Books, I was reading online, I was trying to mind. I was a kid when this was happening, so forgive me for being naive, but I was trying to figure out if it was real or not, and the that tension of they're trying to make it look real, but it might not be real was really intriguing to me at the time. And so this kind of carries a lot of similar elements where a lot of it, yes, there are the movies, but you can also kind of go online and there's ARG stuff. There are websites that kind of tell the larger stories that people try to piece together to put a timeline of when things happen. And I think that's a big part of the appeal for me, the mystery aspect of it.
Yeah. I also was into that. I mean, I like the Cloverfield movies because so much is unexplained also. Mm-hmm. I feel the ARG stuff is fun because it explains just enough without giving any definitive answers, but mm-hmm. it ties you into other human dramas. What I really liked about the first Cloverfield movie was that it was about a sort of shitty privileged New Yorkers and them having to deal with a huge tragedy they can't understand.
Mm-hmm. Want to just quickly tell people what the first
briefly breeze through the plots of the three Cloverfield movies, which I have seen all of them. So the first one is a found footage film. It's a kaiju movie where a giant monster attacks New York. It was famous for having a trailer before the first Transformers movie that did not have the name of the film attached to it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was its big draw. The first time I heard about
that, this series has always been kind of tied up with marketing gimmicks.
Yes. Yeah, I remember watching a shaky phone video of that trailer on YouTube when it first came out. And everybody wanted to know what the fuck it was because all it was sort of a hand, it's handy cam footage, but it looks like a video camera of people out in the street of New York looking around. There's alarms blaring everywhere and you hear an enormous roar. And then you see the head of the Statue of Liberty coming down in front of you. Mm-hmm. And then it was just cut to black date that the film comes out.
Huh.
And there was no title. And that was pretty fucking dope. The movie itself, a lot of people thought it had too much of the shitty New Yorkers and not enough of the monster. Mm-hmm. I thought it was the perfect balance, honestly, and also had Lizzie Kaplan in it, so not mad about that.
So are you kind of a kaiju aficionado? Because I'm not. And my impression is that those movies can focus a lot on the monster, but that, like, some people believe that, like, the best kaiju movie isn't really about the monster at all. It's, like, about the humans.
Yeah. I wouldn't call myself an aficionado. I do have a fascination with sort of the cultural impact of Godzilla, just both to Japan and to America, because it's so transparently about the nuclear bomb. And I do sort of believe that the best kaiju movies are, like, those the original Godzilla movies, which are about tragedy and sort of like an ununderstandable thing causing tragedy. And the kaiju is a stand-in for something you can't, human beings can't understand.
Yeah, that's always been really evocative. Like, you look at something like Attack on Titan, and that's really the reason that I like the series. It's because these big-ass monsters killing everyone, and no one understands why.
Yeah.
Like, why are they eating people? Like, why is... But just the mystery aspect of it.
Yeah.
Like, but then again, you look at something like nature, and it's like, well... You can't really explain why things, like, well, I guess you can.
You see those,
because, like,
those fucked up fish that lived, like, way deep in the sea? You can explain that, but you still can't explain that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you look at the most recent American Godzilla movie, and it's absolutely about our sort of America's...
Wait, which one? Just Godzilla?
Yeah, just Godzilla.
I guess I haven't watched it. When you say the most recent Godzilla movie, I think of Pacific Rim, even though that's, like, not technically a...
Well, that is about environmentalism, really, and also unity and love and, like, working together. And then the American Godzilla one is about sort of American military interventionalism and also the way that the military-industrial complex, it fucks with nature in unpredictable ways. The original Japanese Godzilla is about the bomb. The most recent Japanese Godzilla is about the way that Japanese people solve problems. That's very, it's a weird ensemble piece. It's directed by, I think, Hideaki Anno, who was the director of Evangelion. Please don't write in. Actually, don't write in if I'm wrong, because I will just look it up after the podcast. But I'm pretty sure that's true. And it's so bizarre. It's a really weird movie, and it's like an ensemble piece. There's no clear star. You're just watching, like, a series of Japanese committee members make action, like, itemized action plans to stop Godzilla from destroying Tokyo.
See, I think that's really interesting too, because a lot of Persona, or not Persona, SMT games deal a lot with, like, you're in the post-apocalypse and you're... Well, that's not always the aim of the game, but at least when I'm playing, I'm, like, trying to figure out what it was that caused the world to become that way. And often the police force or whatever was trying to put things in order is still an entity, even though in the post-apocalypse.
Yeah.
And it's always, like, this storyline where it's, like, do you want to go with order, even though they're trying to, like, suppress that this happened? And it's, like, there's always... what I'm saying is... the Japanese media that I've consumed, at least, has an interesting fascination with, like, how the government deals with tragedy specifically.
Yeah. I mean, you definitely see that in the most recent Persona. And definitely in the SMT games. If you look at crime dramas also, there's a fascination with how the police operate. The new Godzilla movie is just about how the Japanese government operates, and it's
I
want to
watch
weird.
It. Oh, but it's would you say it's good?
I think it's good. But it's unlike any kaiju movie I've ever seen, because, like, do you like watching a bunch of people in boardrooms making lists? Because I do, and that's what a lot of this movie is.
Okay, so that was the first movie. It was a lot about New Yorkers being New Yorkers.
I mean, it's about 9/11. We can just say, like, it's a 9/11 movie.
Okay,
and the second one is a paranoia thriller. Like, it's a
It's not a kaiju movie.
It is not a kaiju movie. They're all in different genres. This one is not a found footage movie either. It stars Mary Elizabeth Winstead and John...
They're both really good.
John Goodman, who are acting their little hearts out. They're amazing.
Did this movie win in awards? Because I feel like it should have.
These kinds of movies aren't nominated for anything. So it wasn't going to happen. It was not in the cards. There was some talk, actually, about John Goodman maybe getting a supporting actor or not, but it didn't happen. And Mary Elizabeth Winstead, she gets in a car crash. She wakes up in a bunker. John Goodman tells her the air has been poisoned by some kind of catastrophic event and she's not to go outside. he won't even really let her look outside. So she doesn't really know what's true or not.
Mm-hmm. This guy is just extremely controlling. Like, that's what makes the paranoia. And it's not just her. There's this other guy, right, that I can't remember the circumstances of how all three of them end up in that bunker.
Yeah.
But they're all very tightly controlled by the John Goodman character, who, like, dictates kind of, like, where they sleep, what they can eat, when they do things or something like that.
There's a little bit of a flirtation between Mary Elizabeth Winstead and this guy. And it's not even serious. It's like, maybe we'll have sex to get the tension off. And he is violently opposed to this. Like, her having any kind of sexual relationship with anyone. It's really terrifying.
So that's when it turns from, like, you know, this guy is a little weird to, like, oh my God, is this guy going to murder us? I'm sorry that we're, like, spoiling this movie if you haven't watched it, but, like,
oh, well, if you watch the trailer, you sort of know what's up. I know that people say trailers are full of spoilers, but honestly, it that driving tension is the heart of this movie, and it's very well depicted, I think.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
So I'm going to continue spoiling that movie.
Yes.
So please go forward like a minute or two if you haven't watched it. But
we'll put the timestamps in the post on Kotaku.
Sure. And then, okay, so the movie ends with her leaving. And that entire time you think this guy has lost it. Like, this is clearly not happening. And then she goes outside and it turns out that there is some shit. There's like some weird alien stuff, like just flying around killing things. So you're like, what the hell? So this guy was not just, I mean, he still went too far in all of what he did, but
the point is that, like, he, even if he was right, he was still wrong.
Right.
Yeah. And it's really cool that they went that way instead of having him been just a weird paranoid controlling guy.
So before we get to the third movie, which we also have a lot to say about, one of the things that I found interesting about the first two movies, which ties into the third movie, is that they kind of explain, so at the end of the first movie, people caught that there's, like, in the last scene, there's something that falls into the ocean.
Yeah.
And so, like, no one knew what that was or what that meant for literally years, because J.J. Abrams wouldn't tell anyone. But I think you told me that he had already planned, like, multiple.
He said that he had him and his team, massive air quotes around team, already wrote out a timeline of the Cloverfield universe. Who knows if they're still using this over a decade later? Mm-hmm. But that's what he said.
Right. And so in this, the second movie, people have figured out, or this is one of the theories, I don't know if it's like official, that the guy who's in the bunker must have worked at the place that, like, uncovered the first kaiju in the first movie. So he's, like, related in that way. So then you get to the third movie and you find out what the thing that fell into the ocean was by the end of it.
I am so not a prequel person. Mm-hmm. Cloverfield was the only series that could have tricked me into watching a prequel.
Well, I didn't know this was a prequel either until I was literally.
Nobody knew. They fucking had one trailer during Netflix, the
Super Bowl,
and then suddenly it was on Netflix. I didn't even have time to Google it.
Right. Okay, so now we can start talking about the third movie. Can you want to tell people what
it's
about?
The third movie is massively dumb. It's the most important thing you need to know is how personally targeted I felt about the cast.
Well, do you want to tell people what the premise is?
Man,
first?
they're in space and they're trying to solve the energy crisis with a extremely large particle accelerator, except it opens up alternate universes and they almost all die. And then in the last minute or so of the movie, you find out that what
Spoilers.
What had fallen into the ocean on that last shot was
the first movie
was that shut the escape pod from the space station. Mm-hmm. I am not wholly convinced that this was a planned prequel.
Yeah, I read some criticism that people were like, I think this was just like reshot, or like they just added those scenes to make them connect. But like, whatever the case, the movie started out seeming like it could potentially be good, because I think the premise of it was like, you know, when
multiple timelines open.
But that are existing at the same time, so shit can just get weird. Like,
yeah.
And shit did get weird. So, like, one of the first things that happens is, like, you know, the worms in the spaceship disappear and then they reappear inside of the body of this one dude. Or
yeah,
they find this woman who didn't exist before they turn this on, who's suddenly just like in the middle of the ship, and like in her mind, she's always existed because she's in the other, she was in the other timeline, and they all
knew each
other.
She's like embedded into the wall, like there are electrical cables are going through her leg. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very intense, and there's a bunch of really fun effects and a bunch of the weird shit that all happens. That's always fun to watch. It's just a very stupid movie.
Yeah, because like when
just you so dumb.
When you think about it, none of it makes it. So there's this one part where someone's arm gets cut off, and then the arm suddenly starts moving on its own and writes messages to the team. But it's never explained, like, even if there are multiple universes, like, why did this arm have a mind of its own? Like, in the other universe, the arm wasn't alive. What?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Just doesn't straight up make any sense. And then he tells them to cut open a character who's died, and where they'll find the gyroscope.
But how would it know that?
How would it know that? Nobody knows. Doesn't make any sense. Doesn't make any sense at all.
I mean, I get that on some level, the idea is that, like, anything could happen, right? Like, suddenly you're metallic and the walls are eating
you. It's an excuse to do weird shit.
But I feel like even within that internal logic, it doesn't continue to follow its own internal logic. So there's this guy, again, with the metal example, who is suddenly getting sucked in by the walls. But it only happens at certain times. And then they try to play up, like, you know, he's like, he can't avoid it. Like, it's going to eat him. But, like, how come it's not doing that the entire time? Like, why does it only want to eat him? Like,
there's no explanation. It's not even there's no explanation in an intriguing way. It's just literally there's no explanation. Mm-hmm. Shit just happens in this movie. Events just occur. And there's no through line up for the entire movie, really.
It's just like when it decides that something scary is going to happen.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it means that the walls are coming apart and just like doing all this weird shit.
It wants to be Alien. It wants to be The Thing, but it's just
A lot of comparisons to Event Horizon, which I have not watched.
I have not seen Event Horizon, no.
Where it's kind of like a similar premise where all sorts of horrifying shit happens on a derelict ship. But
sounds cool.
So we've been dunking this movie, but I'll be honest, I still kind of really liked it.
I would watch it again. Like, I was thinking, man, I'd love to watch this the next time I do laundry. That sounds great. So the cast thing, like, when I saw the cast, I, like, completely lost my mind. It's Gugu Mbatha-Raw from that Black Mirror episode about the lesbians in Love.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Oh!
That's her.
I was like, I recognize her, but I wasn't sure. San Junipero?
Yeah, San Junipero. That's her. She is the love interest in the episode.
That. Okay.
And then it's Daniel Brühl, who you might know as Agent Zemo from the most recent Captain America movie, but has also been in a bunch of really cool, weird German movies that I really like. And he wears glasses, which feels like they're targeting me specifically. And then there's Zhang Ziyi, which I don't know. I was thinking, like, maybe last week, man, I wonder what she's doing. And then she shows up in this movie.
What else is she in?
She is Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. She hasn't made a movie in English in a very long time. Mm-hmm. I love the workaround they did where everyone also just speaks Mandarin Chinese. It's implied. And so they speak English to her and she responds in Mandarin, which is great. Chris O'Dowd also in it. He's very funny. And Daniel Oyelowo, which he's a great actor, utterly wasted, but he's a great actor. No one really is, you can see how little everyone gives a shit about this movie while they're acting in it, except maybe Chris O'Dowd, but.
Yeah, no one really has much of a personality or, like, motivations. It's, like, a lot of cliches.
Yeah, there's an angsty Russian who hates the sad German that played by Daniel Brühl. Gugu plays a doctor who's sad because she lost her children. Spoiler alert. Well, I guess you learn that like the first couple of minutes, really. And it's just like one of those so annoying things where like anything could be her motivations. Anything could be her motivation. But they landed on she wants to be your mom.
Which, you know what? That's fine. But I feel like when, at the time comes when she has to make the big moral choice, I'm like, are you like, have you lost it? Like, why? You realize everyone's telling you that there's another you down there. Like, how could you think that you're going to go down there and suddenly your kids have two moms? Like,
yeah. What? How do you think meeting yourself in an alternate universe is not going to destroy the fabric?
Would you do it?
Absolutely not. No. See, I hope my alternate self is also wise enough to not meet me.
See, I would be curious. And I don't know to what degree, like, all the stuff about, like, if you meet yourself in another timeline is just, like, fucking sci-fi mumbo-jumbo of, like, trying to make, like, a drama out of, like, movies that use time travel or whatever. I don't know that I would do it in this – in a situation where I've, like, lost someone and think that suddenly, like, reappearing is, like, I'm going to, like, somehow bridge that gap.
Yeah.
But I would be interested in seeing how I would react to me.
I would love myself. To, I guess, meet an alternate version of me, but I would like, just send me a letter. Like, I don't need to meet you face to face. We don't know what's going to happen. I feel like you.
But you wouldn't believe. So in the movie, she does send like a voicemail to herself.
Yeah.
I feel like if that happened to me, I would think someone was pranking me. I wouldn't believe it.
Just getting pranked by yourself. I would prank myself. I feel like that's something I would do. I would absolutely punk myself.
So like now I feel like I have to come up with some sort of phrase if like I ever am in a situation where I'm going to meet my, where like I have to communicate with myself from the future or the past.
The dog rises at midnight. It's Patricia, hello. Yeah, it's, the Cloverfield Paradox isn't good, but this is the kind of fan service that I actually like. Mm-hmm. It is just a dumb science fiction romp with a bunch of really attractive actors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice. You know, it's a nice time.
I think for me, it's also just the ARG stuff. Like, even though I think the connections to the other movies are so slight, having to sit down and figure out like, oh, okay, well, this scene implies this and this website says this, that I don't know what it is about that stuff that just kind of sucks me in.
I looked at all the old ARG stuff after the movie ended, actually. Like, I immediately started Googling all those old websites. And
I think there are new websites now, too.
Oh, my God. There are new websites. Between this and the upcoming No Man's Sky ARG, I'm going to just never get offline.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I think it's just like trying.
Do you remember that Halo ARG, I Love Bees?
I never participated in it, but I know it's like the most famous.
It was really
gaming
cool
ARG.
It was super cool.
And like now, I think there's a certain art to it because so many things want to try to do it. Where it's like, look at this secret website. It leads you to blah and blah and blah, but it's so difficult to actually get right. And I think J.J. Abrams in particular, or his team, whoever is slapping his name on things, does a lot of experiments with, like, form. He wrote a book where it's, like, this – it's an actual book, but, like, the story is actually these things that people are writing in the margins, and they're writing letters to each other, and they're embedding different things. So like there's like a map in the middle of the book, or like this post-it note, and just all these different things that you like kind of have to like figure out like what the story is and like how it relates to each other. And so I've always kind of been fascinated with the way that he will tell stories, even though he's also known for like making like the most like, I don't know, cookie cutters, like boring ass.
I mean, my problem with J.J. Abrams is not, I mean, the lens flare thing is very tiresome. But my problem with J.J. Abrams is always that he has a really good ideas for hooks and then absolutely no follow through. Oh. Just like his best stuff are like the pilot from Lost, where he just comes in, drops an amazing hook, and then leaves. And like Lost, I don't think is a perfect product as a television show because they never lived up to the promise of that big hook in that first episode. Mm-hmm. But man, did that lead to some really exciting television. Some mm-hmm. very good episodes of television came because J.J. Abrams just came, dropped one good idea, and then left. Mm-hmm. When you put him in charge of a project like Star Trek.
So he might be like one of the only examples of like, because you know how people are like, you can't just be an idea person. Like, that's not a job. I guess J.J. Abrams proves everyone wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, I know he probably has other talents other than just coming up with shit.
But I mean, like, he can shoot a movie. I sometimes think about how difficult it is to be a director on a movie. That must mm-hmm. be a time-consuming and frustrating thing to do. So that's impressive. It's just that his initial hook ideas are always better than his actual, like, full conception.
Mm-hmm. So he needs to come up with something and then someone else needs to do it.
Yeah. I mean, whenever he's working, on the first Cloverfield, he was working with, I think, Damon Lindelof from Lost.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So it ended up, I think, you can see what parts of the movie are very Lindelof and what parts of the movie are very Abrams, but they work very well together, I think. And I think that movie had just enough of the Abrams intrigue without any follow through and Lindelof's very good read on how human behavior works and mm-hmm. the ways in which people are selfish.
Yeah, Lindelof, I'm really fascinated by him as a storyteller. I've only watched The Leftovers. I have Good not job. Watched Lost, even though I'm intrigued because so many people that I respect really love that show. And so I'm curious if it still stands up or if I wouldn't like it. But yeah, The Leftovers is so much about really like good. How humans interact and like framing belief and all this other like very kind of high concept stuff that I think in the hands of anyone else, it would be so difficult to, like, you know, sell the idea of, like, how grief can eat someone.
Yeah.
Like, it's very easy to depict something very cliche, like, you know, you look sad, you're wearing all black, you're depressed and don't do the things that you used to do, or you lash out on people. But, like, his depiction of these ideas are just, like, so nuanced and complex. So I feel like now maybe I should just go back and watch Cloverfield 2, because the first Cloverfield, yeah. out of
Cloverfield,
curiosity.
Comma, as well.
Yeah, because I didn't know he was involved in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a perfect movie. If you have a problem with fan footage stuff, it did make a lot of people super nauseous in theaters. You might find it frustrating. I remember when I was watching it, my brother had just moved to New York, where he lived for a couple years after college, and they're coming out of some subway station, and they're saying the name of the station over and over again because they're like, it's the station, it's the station. My brother looked at me with such frustration in his eyes and said, that is absolutely 100% not that station. It's like, New Yorkers are fucking crazy. But it was sort of, I think, the most honest movie about 9/11 or about how most of the country reacted to 9/11. With just fear and paranoia and having no idea how to react in the face of tragedy. You know, Lizzie Kaplan's in it again. I think she's a very funny, great actress. You might get really annoyed at the framing device, which is about a business guy who's moving to a high-powered job in Japan, except, oh no, his ex-girlfriend, he's still in love with her, and she doesn't want to see him go, even though she's not seeing him anymore. And it takes like a good 20 minutes to set that up. And people found that very irritating.
Mm.
I didn't think it was that bad because it was a compelling drama. Mm-hmm. At least it's something you'd see in a soap opera. And people watch those for a reason. But yeah, it's got some good shots.
You know what? Like, even though I don't know that I would recommend most people watch the latest Cloverfield movie, I'm still really excited for the actual movie that's coming out in theaters, which apparently is happening sometime
this year.
Yeah.
Overlord, it's called. It's set during World War II, which really intrigues me. Entirely male cast, which I guess I understand because of the setting, but that intrigued me less. Still, I'm very interested to see how a Cloverfield movie works as a period piece.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's about American soldiers discover that the Nazis they're fighting are using supernatural means to fight them. So that sounds kind of dope.
Yeah, I'm also just kind of interested in Cloverfield as this like weird movie version of like the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, like an anthology series. I think that is a very interesting thing for this to become. And a lot of it does have to do with J.J. Abrams' fondness for marketing gimmicks. So the Cloverfield, 10 Cloverfield Lane, it was not originally a Cloverfield film, and they brought it into the canon. And they just kind of announced at Comic-Con, oh, yeah, it's wrapped shooting, and it's going to come out in 4 months, mm-hmm. by the way.
What's the marketing gimmick for the next movie?
I mean, again, nobody knows what it is. And nobody knows when it's going to come out. I assume it's going to just be one of those.
What if it just comes out without a trailer?
What if it comes out tomorrow? What if I personally get a Blu-ray DVD email like mailed to me by J.J. Abrams?
What if J.J. Abrams comes to your house through the window and like puts the DVD in your PS4 and is just waiting for you on your couch?
What if you're filling up your car at the gas station and someone puts, you know, a bag over your head and you're screaming and you're crying and then you wake up an hour later in a chair and you're strapped to it and it's J.J. Abrams and he's there and he's like, you're going to watch Overlord right now. And you're like, I don't want to, J.J. I don't want to. And he's like, you're going to.
And only one person watches the movie and they have to tell everyone else about it. And it's like it's like this mystery of like, does it exist? Only this one crazy person says they were kidnapped by J.J. Abrams.
If someone emailed me tomorrow and was like, I was kidnapped by J.J. Abrams and he made me watch Overlord, I was like, you know what? Fair enough. That sounds real. That checks out to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, people have as much anticipation for that actually movie as sort of what the weird lead up to it will be. Mm-hmm. Nothing, though, will ever be as bold as attaching a 1 minute trailer to one of the biggest movies that year and not putting the name of your movie on it. That is just such a baller move, and I really have respect for that.
I'm kind of shocked that he hasn't tried just, like, releasing it on piracy websites and just, like, not bypassing
all of them. Someone check the torrents now for Overlord 2018.
Yeah, what if it's out there already?
That would be actually very dope. I would be into that. I think that's the one last frontier for him. Mm-hmm. I've seen some people saying that Netflix's acquisition of these movies that were meant to be, Cloverfield Paradox was meant to be a Paramount release, and then Netflix bought it for $50 million. Mm-hmm. And some people are saying this isn't like Netflix is spinning this as some sort of prestige event, but this is Netflix just picking up a direct-to-DVD movie, and mm-hmm. it definitely feels like a direct-to-DVD movie.
Yeah, you know what? It's been interesting because, like, that used to be such a thing in the blockbuster era, and you got to think the quality of, like, direct-to-DVD movies must still exist, but, like, where do they go? Is that just Netflix now?
I mean, I'm not mad about it. Mm-hmm. I think they're more interesting movies than a lot of actual direct-to-DVD movies. Mm-hmm. I feel like we should be more realistic about what these movies are. Mm-hmm. And this isn't Netflix as a movie studio. This is Netflix picking off cast-offs from big studios.
And I mean, Netflix does do prestige stuff, but I feel like the bulk of what I watch on it is like designed in such a way that it's like inherently vapid because it's meant for you to kind of binge watch it. Like it's more about like the hook of you continuing to watch the thing. Like this was the case when I watched the OA. Like looking back, I don't know that I would say the OA is good, but it's certainly good at least getting you being like, what the like?
Yeah, the last fuck is 5 minutes, there's always an enormous twist in that show, and you're like mad because you're like,
I don't want to watch it, but I want to know what happens. And it's like, it's not good. It's just very good at like.
I heard the same thing about Altered Carbon, which immediately got suggested to me as soon as I finished the Cloverfield Paradox.
Oh, yeah.
Eric, you
watched it?
I didn't. I turned it off because I was like, it's 2 a.m. But Eric from Compete told me he finished. What he said specifically, Eric Van Allen, bless your heart, mm-hmm. was, yeah, I finished the Altered Carbon. Don't know why I did, though.
Well, I feel like that's such an interesting compulsion because, like, they don't have a... I don't feel like they have a mandate to make good stuff, because you think about how you use Netflix, you might just turn it on in the background while you're doing like a chore or you like just to pass the time when
you're bored.
Lord
knows how many weird television shows I put on in the background because they are a human being talking that are just on Netflix. Mm-hmm. I watched Zumbo's Just Desserts for like a day while I was trying to write something. This weird, really weird Australian reality show, reality baking show. And the amount of times those Australians say Zumbo is, like, very intense. He's a very famous Australian baker, apparently. But, mm-hmm. I mean, Zumbo. His name's Zumbo. Mm-hmm. So, much love to Australians.
So I think Cloverfield kind of is in that same space where it's, like, it doesn't have to be good, but it because so much just, like, weird shit happens in it, you kind of just strap on for the ride to, like, figure out where it's going to go or where it's going to end. But yeah, Netflix, I feel like, is just this thing that I watch when I don't really want to think about anything.
Yeah, it's really remarkable to me that they haven't acquired all of America's Next Top Model because that is the purpose it serves in my life. It's just like to be on, just to be on. Mm-hmm. I really don't actually like having background noise all day long. I usually put on music if I'm going to have background noise rather than like watch TV or listen to a podcast. But I do understand that, like, sometimes, especially if I'm on the couch writing. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a big thing for me. If I'm sitting on the couch writing, I will turn on the television and just let it go. And I think that's a very modern thing that Netflix really understands, for better or for worse.
It's kind of like how you start off watching something on YouTube and, like, an hour later, you're like, I don't understand how I got from that point to point.
So... This is such a tangent. I'll keep it brief. There's this YouTube channel called Look Mom No Computer, which is just this very hyperactive 26-year-old from Brighton who makes all of his own synthesizers and tells you how. And he makes this ridiculous shit. He made a flamethrower organ. Mm-hmm. And it's just like me and my friends got sucked into a hole watching these guys. He made a bike that was also a synthesizer, a BMX bike that's also a synthesizer.
Of course.
And yeah, he'll just show you how he did all this shit. He made an oscillator, an oscillating synth with 100 different oscillators in it.
Wow.
So wait,
how did you find out about this?
Well, my friend Sean actually is totally obsessed with synthesizers. He comes over to our house to watch the Waco miniseries with us and then brings us wine and talks about synthesizers afterward. We've just listened to a Italo Disco.
You're framing this as like a thing that happens to you. Someone just
I mean, so often I get back from work and my roommate is like, oh, Sean's coming over. We're going to watch Waco. And I'm like, all right. I like Sean. I like Waco. And then, yeah, we just put on a Italo Disco and then he can name every synthesizer that's in all of those videos because he's a freak of nature. And so he was looking for, like, actual schematics on how to build something that Look Mom No Computer had built. And he stumbled on one of these videos and was like, this man's insane. I love him. And I now also love him. Anyone who makes a synth bike, really, that's impressive.
It's a way to your heart.
Yeah. Just make me a synth bike. Then we can talk.
So for our second topic, you wanted to discuss a little bit about when games kind of spark you into taking up something new.
Yeah. Or at least urge me to do something in my own personal life. I had been playing Battle Chef. What the name of that game is right
now? Battle Chef Brigade?
Brigade. Yeah. Why is that word so hard? Battle Chef Brigade. There we go.
It's a lot of bees.
It's a lot of bees. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of bees. So I've been doing Battle Chef Brigade, and in that game, you play as a magic, you know, knight who fights all these beasts, these like fantasy beasts, and uses the things that they fought and killed as ingredients in like an Iron Chef style cook-off. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I really liked about this game is that all of the illustrations of food look incredible.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're really, really pretty. It's like you know how like anime food always looks amazing?
I was just thinking about that. When people share gifts and it's like, doesn't this make you hungry?
And I'm like, yeah, it does. Yeah. Just like anime illustrations of eggs or like ramen, anime illustrations of ramen.
I mean, to be fair, so when I'm in America, I don't, you know, I'll eat eggs when I'm hungover most of the time, but I don't really eat eggs that often. But when I'm in Japan, like, even just getting literally hard-boiled eggs from 7-Eleven are so incredible. They taste different. Yeah, I don't know what it is.
They have a different actual sort of process for eggs. They're fresher, I think, is the number one thing. I know that the yolks are different color because they are like fresher.
Darker orange.
Yeah, it's a higher fat content. Mm. And I think it has to do with how they treat the chickens.
But yeah, I would literally go and just buy an egg every day that I was in Japan. But sorry, keep on.
Yeah, I'm hungry now. I was already thinking about getting ramen and bubble tea. And now I think I'm definitely getting ramen and bubble tea for dinner. And it made me just really want to cook all this stuff. Especially, I just got an Instant Pot for Christmas. My dad got it for me. Thanks, Dad. Shout outs to Dad. And you can make like soup dumplings in there. Mm-hmm. And I've been, you know, I'm going to get like one of those little steamer, you know, those straw little steamer things and think I'm going to try to make soup dumplings. Ooh. Every time I play this game, I just really am motivated to try new recipes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just was wondering, like, I don't know, I feel like that isn't necessarily new for me, but it was never so pronounced as it was when I played Battle Chef Brigade.
Mm-hmm. So I've never had an instance, I don't think, of like a game making me want to do stuff. It's just more like there will be times when I'm like, I want to do this because I'm playing in a game. Like, I think the number one thing is always like, I should learn Japanese. Like, that's and I'm going to say this to myself every year until like maybe one year it becomes a like resolution and I finally fucking do it, because then I can, I don't know, watch anime or like get video game news early or whatever. Like, it's useful in my job, but like one of these days.
Yeah. I think a lot of the time, sometimes games make me feel like I want to be more athletic. Because you spend so much time parkouring in, like, most games.
That's another one where it's like, I kind of want to learn this. And then I'm like, Patricia, you're never going to learn how to do parkour. Like,
you're never going to rock climb. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, New York City wouldn't be bad for parkour. Just very dangerous. So I guess don't do it.
I'm scared of everything in New York City. It's just so, I feel like most people who learn how to do it must live in, like, cities that aren't quite as bustling as this one.
It seems like a Bay Area hobby, you know?
I just imagine New Yorkers yelling at you for like, for like parkouring around.
I absolutely can imagine that. I can imagine being so aggressively disdained by other New Yorkers. You ever watch? Today I got mad. I slipped. It was snowing a little bit today when I was walking to work. And I slipped and fell. And, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal. I just got up afterward. It's just,
if you knew
those
how to parkour, you wouldn't have slipped and fallen.
I got mad at someone today, though. He looked me in the eyes and gave me a concerned look, and I was like upset that he did that, because the New Yorkers don't look each other in the eyes.
So it was like an insult that he cared.
Yeah, it was. Weirdly, I was insulted. I was like, oh, you don't think I can handle myself? Get out of here.
Oh my god, it's so...
Hey, I'm walking here.
Yeah, that's one of the things that gets me about living here, that I keep thinking like, am I going to grow old here? Because I never see, like, old people out on the trains. I know they exist.
Yeah. You move upstate. Or you move to Westchester. That's what
I
you
just
do.
Just imagine how grueling it is to, like, try to, like, elbow your way in into the fucking train, or, like, walk fast enough so that people don't hate you on the street.
That's true. People get so... I have one time right outside of the office, which is over by Union Square. It's, like, a very busy part of New York. I did get mad because a family of tourists were standing in the middle of that crosswalk where you walk towards Union Square. They were standing in the middle of it to try to get a picture of the sunset. And I was like, I need to walk.
I hate that. When people aren't aware of how much space they're taking, or they're just standing in like the middle of a thing.
Yeah.
And
New
just
York
getting
sidewalks
in the way
are very narrow. You cannot ever walk 3 abreast. Don't do it.
But people do it all the time. I don't understand.
I
have all these situations where like 4 people are walking in a certain direction, and I can kind of tell that me walking in the opposite direction is like kind of annoying them because, like, one of them has to move. And I'm like, what the did you not expect anyone to walk in the opposite direction of the thing?
One time in Brooklyn, this girl, I was wearing this, like, very cool, actually, like, a weird shawl with armholes in it. And I felt really hot. Mm-hmm. And this lady steps on it, like, steps all the way up it and makes me fall and doesn't say anything to me. And,
like, well, what if she was like, she's a real New Yorker. She can handle it.
I've just understood the catch-22 of being a New Yorker on the street. You can't apologize when you fuck up incredibly badly. She, like, stepped all the way up me. It was, like, egregious. It was very intense. But, yeah, I mean, it is sort of prohibitive trying to learn. Like, when I played Zelda, I also wanted to cook a lot because the food in that game looks really amazing. But it was also, like, wouldn't it be cool if I could rock climb? It would be cool if I could do that.
I mean, okay, so I kind of had the same feeling with Zelda, but the thing is, my cooking would never match the Zelda thing because I feel like the large part of the appeal is the whole, like, song and dance of it, that it's just, like, the ingredients are bouncing and, like, his reaction.
Link's, like, mystified expression every single time.
Yeah, or, like, for those of you who are playing Monster Hunter World, I adore the cutscene that plays when you, because you have to, like, cook something before you go out hunting, and it gives you, like, bonuses, stat bonuses. But in this game, the palicos, which are really just cats, the cute cats, cook the stuff for you. Oh, and it's just, like, so lavish, and they're having so much fun making it.
Oh, that's out of control.
But it's like, okay, the food looks good, and I acknowledge that, and it's delicious, and I'm sure I would enjoy it. But me cooking it wouldn't be the same as, like, all these tiny cats making it for me in, like, a giant delight.
Ori's never going to cook your food for you.
No, she's just going to eat it.
There is something, I find something weirdly satisfying about most video game crafting systems, especially ones that have to do with food. Mm-hmm. I always got really fascinated by the weird foods in Dishonored. Mm-hmm. And I also want to make
so
a lot of those.
Gross,
they're
aren't
so
they?
Nasty looking.
Is that just, like, a European thing?
It, like, seems like a cruel mockery of British foods, which, I mean, British people have weird foods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just remember things like canned, like, eel or something, or, like, canned fish or something.
Yeah, there's, like, a bunch of, like, canned seafood things and a lot of, like, treacle tart stuff, like, very sickly sweet desserts. And then the bread you find is also really weird and dense. Mm-hmm. And it's just, like, some of the desserts do look good. They had, like, fruit tarts and fruit pies that looked really tasty. But most of the, like, common people food is, like, canned eels and, like, weird preserved parts of animals that you don't normally eat.
Gross.
Yeah. Most video games.
Well, now I don't want to eat anymore.
I'm not hungry anymore. I talked myself out of having ramen and bubble tea.
So, I guess third topic, and that was kind of like our mini topic. You wanted to talk about Shadow of the Colossus, right?
Yes, which I have not yet played, but I'm going to start tonight. Part of it is because tonight I'm going to finally have time to play it. And also, there's been this ongoing conversation about this remake that I find this argument to be a little bit silly, but I understand where it's coming from.
There's just, like, this anxiety around it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, there's, like, anxiety is a very good word for it. It's the idea that maybe by remaking this beloved game, not just remastering it, but remaking it wholesale, we've undone some of the magic of the original Shadow of the Colossus. Mm-hmm. I mean, I played Shadow of the Colossus on PS2. I wasn't that good at it. I didn't beat it, but I did play it because I wanted to have the experience of it. And when I, you know, when at the time, there was only the original PS2 version. I got a copy at, like, a Blockbuster, you know, going out of business sale. And I had my brother's PS2, so I sat down and played it. And it did feel cool that how much they could achieve in that original game engine on a technology that was so busted.
Yeah, I saw someone now in 2018, like an animator, being like, he was showing, I think, the wireframes of the animations, and he's like, for this time and age, all of the complex animations that they made were, like, so above and beyond, like, kind of what you could expect from games of that era. And never mind, obviously, the design stuff that was, like, so inspired and so, like, clearly the result of, like, a specific vision. Like, here's an open world game in which you don't have a million things to do. You only have one goal, and that's to kill all the colossi. And you then, through the progress of playing it, you kind of figure out that at first you think you're doing the right thing. You're trying to, like, you're trying to revive your sister, your girlfriend?
Your girlfriend.
And then you kind of realize that, like, these Colossi aren't enemies. They're just kind of trying to live their life, and you're kind of evil for killing them, and you like, and so there's, you know, it's kind of gone down as this game that's, like, in the video game canon as, like, a complete masterpiece or whatever. And the thing with the remake is, it's not just that they've updated the visuals, although I think there's some contention around that too, because it's like there's something magical
about when they removed some fog in some areas. I don't know for sure.
Or that just the fact that there's more detail and you can more clearly understand what things look like takes away some of the mystique of, like, because like when you play older games and they have to kind of make sacrifices because they can't make something realistic, you have to bring in more, right? Like, you have to use more of your imagination. And through that, a thing kind of becomes imbued with more magic, right? Like, you... Mario isn't just Mario, right? Yeah. Like, you look at these very simple, like, pixel graphics or whatever, and even though they're simple, the very specific choices that they make may bring them to life in a way that, like, something realistic couldn't be, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's a reason that we don't have a hyper-realistic, like, 25-year-old Mario that where you can, like, tell every one of his wrinkles. Like, there's something preserved in the fact that there's less detail to him and more cartoonish. So aside from the graphical stuff, I think some of the anxiety is that, like, it's not just even a straight up remake. They've added other stuff to it. Like, I know that there's, like, an Easter egg to the what was the game before this by the same director?
Eco.
No, after that.
Guardians. The
Last Guardian.
There's, I was, like, about to say Of the Galaxy, but it was not that.
So there's, like, a reference to that game in there in a thing that didn't exist.
Yeah.
And now I know Heather wrote about...
coins in the game. Yeah, the magical players coins. Don't know what they do because they were not in the original game.
And so, you know, the game hasn't been out for that long, so it's entirely possible there are other Easter eggs and other things that people haven't found. So there's kind of this sense of, like, why are you changing or adding or altering this thing that's already widely considered a masterpiece?
Yeah, it's sort of like, I guess what I would compare it to, I think the only comparison I can make to other art is the original Michael Haneke version of Funny Games was produced in Austria with Austrian and French actors. And then he remade it a couple of years later in English using American money with, like, Michael Roth. And
but the same person remade it.
The same person remade it. Huh. And it's a shot-for-shot remake. It is nearly identical.
That's really interesting from, like, an artistic perspective of, like, did it come across as, like, him trying to fix his mistakes? Because, like, I think the thing with the game is a little different in that it was remade by a different team kind of trying to interpret the intentions of the original team. And because it's still Sony, I'm sure there was some, like,
I'm sure they had some sort of, like, Bible to use
or
to,
like,
make sure
they probably had access to some of the people, but there's still this element of, like, translation, right? Versus, like, the example that you're bringing up, it's the same person,
the same exact person. I mean, but working with the reason why he remade it, Funny Games is this, It's a whole thing. It's like a fourth wall breaking horror movie that I really liked the first time I watched it. I haven't watched it for years because it's, like, very disturbing. And also, I don't know, it might just not be as good as I remember it. It's just something I'm afraid of also, which I think might actually be some of the anxiety about the Shadow of the Colossus thing too. Mm-hmm. Is what if you play it and have to compare it to modern games and it's not as good as you remember it being? Mm-hmm. But part of the reason you made it is because not a lot of people had seen the Austrian version, and he wanted people to see it. Like, it was a movie that had a very distinct and aggressive message about violence in the media, and he wanted the English-speaking world to be able to experience it. So he got Michael Roth and Naomi Watts, and he remade it. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's as good, but he also, like, you can tell he had a lot more money, and he was able to sort of push... the cinematography wasn't all that different, but it was a lot cleaner and sharper, and he had better equipment. And, you know, he's working with, you know, Michael Pitt, all these, like, great actors. They were giving it, sort of really acting the hell out of it. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to see, you know. Mm-hmm. It is, again, I mean, the same creative force behind it. Mm-hmm. But I think it had a lot of the same motivations. I mean, I think the reason I get a cynical a lot about a lot of capitalism things. Mm-hmm. You know me. You work in the same office with me. But it's hard for me to get cynical about accessibility of games, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you got to think like, okay, quote unquote, everyone knows that this game is a masterpiece. But also, like, there have been now we're two generations away from that era, like more than ever before, people aren't keeping discs, right? And so, like, you have these new generation of gamers who are not going to have a PS2.
And
you know?
I'm lucky that my older brother never sold his PS2. Mm-hmm. That's the only reason I was able to play the first one, and was like picking up a used copy of the game at a place where they did not know how much money it was worth, and then also already having a PS2. You can pick them up pretty cheap if you know where to get them, but like most of the time, people aren't thinking, oh, I need to have a PlayStation 2 so I can play all these classic games.
And I guess this particular example becomes weird because they did remaster it, right? Like, wasn't there another version of that came out not too long ago? And then it was kind of weird for them to announce, hey, here's an entirely new, like, remake of it. And I think also, what the whole capitalistic thing, I think, is on the forefront of a lot of people's minds, because there's kind of this narrative, I think, that video game companies are only out to squeeze as much money out from the consumer. And so now you have all these games that are kind of being re-released or like remastered or remade. And it's just this constant thing.
And it's not wrong. Some of those do seem like money grabs, especially when they're done cheaply and poorly. I remember the Silent Hill collection for the Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3. Absolute shit. It was a very, very bad remaster. And it seemed like they were just trying to get people to buy something that said Silent Hill on it.
I'm trying to think, like, is this as much of a problem in other industries? Like, I know that they re-release movies with, like, more extras, right? But there, I feel like I've... And maybe
the
it's
music
because I'm,
industry, I feel oh, yeah? like, is... I mean, especially with vinyl versions, vinyl re-releases of old albums, they... You'll see a lot of vinyl people saying that they just don't sound as good because they're not, the audio is mastered differently and it just doesn't sound as good. But it does. That's not even the issue. It's just like we're releasing Abbey Road for like the 6 billionth time in a different format. Mm-hmm. You don't need all of those. And it's just about trying to get money out of the Beatle estate. You know, like that's all it is about. You don't need Bangers by Miley Cyrus on vinyl, and yet it exists on vinyl.
Why not? I guess
they gotta sell something at Urban Outfitters.
I feel like people talk about vinyl more so than I know people who actually own vinyl. Do you own a vinyl?
Yeah, I'm a huge asshole. So I have a record player, and I have like a not insignificant vinyl collection.
What was the last vinyl that you bought?
I got the Piss Jeems album, Why Love Now. I actually got that pretty recently because I was like, this album is good enough that I actually want to have it on vinyl. And that reminds me, I want to pick up Anna Birch's debut album on vinyl also.
So my next question is, how often do you use your vinyl?
I think about once a month. I make a cup of tea and no one's in the apartment and I lay down on the couch and I put a record on and read a book. When I lived alone, honestly, I used it all the fucking time.
Oh, yeah.
I have some really good records. I've got the Go-Go's, the one, you know, We Got the Beat, that on it. I got the Elvis Costello with Allison on it. I've got an alternate cover version of the Japan album, The Art of Parties, which is very good. When I lived alone, I always listened to music like pretty much all of the time. So I was always using my record player. Now that I live with other people, it's harder.
Yeah. But so vinyl has always been one of those things for me where I'm like, I kind of want it, but I feel like in my heart of hearts, I know that I would buy it, and I'm sure I would buy many different albums, but then I probably wouldn't use it all that much.
Wanna
I think
hear
is
something.
My big fear.
Yeah. Well, something super obnoxious, too. What? In the music industry, it's not even vinyl that's hot anymore. All the, like,
is it cassettes
cool,
now?
All the cool indie artists are putting their shit out on cassette because it's so cheap.
Yeah.
Cassette is just so cheap to produce. So now it's, like, not even cool to have vinyl.
Yeah, I feel like there's something inherently cooler about, like, cassettes. Like, you look at something like Guardians of the Galaxy, the whole, like, thing where he has his cassette and whatever. And it's, like, more portable and like the Walkman kind of looks.
Yeah.
The old ass Walkmans look cool and stuff. So.
Yeah, they do look really cool. Those old 70s Walkman with the fake wood, you know, texture on it. I've talked myself out of getting an old shitty boombox to hook up to my speakers so many times, and I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to get a cassette console because I just can't allow myself to. Like, how do you even display cassettes? What do you store them in? Like a shoebox? Because that's what I stored them in when I was a kid.
No, I can see. You can just line them up.
Oh, like, my God. I don't even want to think about the logistics of this because it's just going to be another road I go down. I'm buying everything on cassette.
Yeah, next episode, Gita, tell us about your cassette collection.
Oh, my God. They're so cheap. I mean, that's like the main reason. And that was, it was actually vinyl for a long time.
But then why is there a craze around it? Like, do they not upsell them?
No, I mean, a part of it just is vinyl for independent artists, especially, extremely, extremely expensive to produce. And because it's gotten more popular, it's only gotten more expensive to produce. And, you know, artists are waiting longer for their records to get back from the plants. So if you want to actually just get something out quickly on a format that people can listen to, cassettes are the way to go. At this point, it's easy to print stuff to cassette. The cassette industry has actually been pretty, I think, stronger than the vinyl industry was when it had a resurgence because of prisons. Mm-hmm. You can only get books on cassette in prison if you're going to listen to books on tape.
So, sorry that Shadow of the Colossus. I don't understand the. I feel like it's the kind of this haughty kind of critic-led thing where it's like I don't want my baby to be like.
I
messed with.
Understand it, I think. I understand the idea of, like, losing the magic of something by remaking it. Like, remaking it wholesale instead of just remastering it. I understand feeling like that infringes on that art. But I also feel like video games are a special case where, for the most part, you can watch. You have a lot more access to movies, even movies where the prints are partially gone. And you have a lot more access to music, and you have a lot of access to art, like, pretty much everywhere. There's very few things that you can't actually, that aren't on display for the public to see. But with video games, it is a time and money commitment that makes it much more difficult. I'm not going to tell a 14-year-old that really wants to understand why games are good to go buy a PlayStation 2 and play this game with really difficult, clumsy controls just because it's a classic. You're only going to get that kid into it if it's out on the latest console in a format that they have access to. Mm-hmm. It's just about access. And I know, yeah, they already did a remaster, but let's be real. Just, you know, it's...
For me, it's just like, okay, if I honestly think that a new version is going to kill the magic, then it's like, well, I'm not going to play it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't object...
You have a choice here,
yeah,
also.
I'm not going to object to existing. Like, I don't think that it's, like, so sacred that it can't exist. I'm just not going to play it. Like, it's simple.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it... I think getting mad at people for not having the same value judgments about art as you do is a little bit silly. I used to get mad about other people's taste in everything, but then I was like, wait, that doesn't actually prevent me from liking things or disliking things if someone else has a different opinion. And I used to get fearful of people liking things the wrong way or for the wrong reasons. But I think all that really matters is that people like things genuinely and have an enthusiasm for things. I'm not going to be the person that tells someone that's playing the Shadow of the Colossus for the first time because of the remake.
That they're playing the wrong version or something.
Yeah, exactly. That's just not who I'm going to be. So I think that is a good place to end that conversation. It's a very good episode and a very nice chat, Patricia. So you can find us on Twitter at our work on Kotaku. You can email us at favethis@kotaku.com or tweet at us with the hashtag favethis, and we will read those tweets. I want to thank you to Montana Mofidi, the executive director of audio, Levi Sharp, who got us set us up in the booth. Mellow Makes, who makes our themes music, and Stuart Wood, who does the music for our commercials. And that is all the things I have to say at the end of the episode. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening. Next week. Bye.